Tonight on Arena, director Sam Hopkinson on his documentary Misha and the Wolves, and The Sound of Dundalk in Iron Annie, the debut novel from Luke Cassidy. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In 1997, a book was published entitled Misha, a memoir of the Holocaust years. It told the remarkable story of a young Jewish girl who survived the Holocaust and wandered Europe searching for her parents, who had been deported by the Nazis. Written by Misha Di Fonseca, the memoir included extraordinary details of how she was adopted on her journey by a pack of wolves. Unfortunately, although a bestseller in many countries, the book turned out to be a massive hoax, and the story of that hoax is told in a new documentary from director Sam Hopkinson. The documentary is called Misha and the Wolves. I'm delighted to have Sam Hopkinson join me on the line now. It really is a compelling documentary, and it says a lot about people's willingness, I think, Sam, to buy into stories. In fact, our own willingness as viewers to buy into the story that you tell us as well. We'll come back to that. But first of all, let's go to the origin of this story, the book, Misha, a memoir of the Holocaust years. What story did that book tell before anybody knew it was a hoax?
It told a story of a girl who, a young Jewish girl who was, whose parents were deported from Brussels in Belgium during the Second World War, and a girl who was forced to or made to live with a Catholic family to hide her. She was a hidden child, essentially. She didn't get on with the family. She decided to strike out and go and try and find her parents. And she walked, and all she knew is they were in the east. She walked east, and the book chronicles her adventures as she walks through the forests of Europe in search of her parents, befriended by wolves, encountering Nazi soldiers, and eventually she doesn't find her parents, but she has a sort of life-changing experience as a young child, turning away from the barbarity, I suppose, of adults and finding solace in the natural world.
In fact, that wolves aspect of the story that she originally told, it's quite extraordinary. And you might, if you were cynical, cock your ear up slightly when you hear she was brought up by wolves. But it's very convincingly told by her in the book and in the various interviews she did around the time of the publication of the book.
It is. I mean, she was somebody who knew and understood, or is somebody who knows and understands animals. And this turned out not to be true, as you said, but she took in, wolf experts along the way with her descriptions of how her interactions with the wolves went. They're not overwritten in a sense. They're subtle.
Yeah, she seemed to know what she was about when it came to the wolves, however she found that piece of information out. Because let's listen to a clip from the documentary where, in fact, we have a wolf handler. This is much later on. The Oprah Winfrey Show was interested in doing a segment on Misha and her story, and obviously the wolves bit was going to be important, so they got in touch with a wolf sanctuary in Massachusetts. They went to tape there, and Joni Sofron was the wolf handler who became involved with, first of all, the Oprah Winfrey Show and indeed Misha herself. And this is what Joni has to say about Misha and her ability in and around wolves.
Misha was very different from most people I'd ever met. My first impression was she probably should have been an animal, or her spirit is an animal. She spoke about being accepted by the pack, but being treated as a low-ranking member, and that she had to exhibit submissive, low-ranking behavior in order to be with them. Misha said the alpha male typically would eat first. The others would lay around the carcass waiting for their turn. They would leave a little scraps, sort of in close proximity to where she was when they were finished. When We became very good friends.
You got it.
She visited multiple times. She would hand feed them the pieces of meat.
That's Joni Safran, a wolf handler, and that's from the documentary Misha and the Wolves, the director Sam Hopkinson with me now. Joni tells it exactly, and when you see that, you think, well, clearly this woman, whatever, because at this stage in the documentary, we kind of know that there's a hoax involved, but you're saying she somehow knows things about wolves, however she managed to do that. But Joni was not the first person who was taken in. The really nasty bit of the first taking in of people, if you like, is the people in the synagogue in America where Misha was living.
Yeah. And of course, these were friends and neighbors whose hearts went out to Misha. She decided to tell the story for the first time to these people one Holocaust Memorial Day. And they didn't know. I mean, you know, many survivors live for years harboring stories that are just too hard for them to tell. And here was a friend of theirs, somebody who'd come from Belgium and been taken in by the local Jewish community, coming out with this extraordinary, and heart, you know, I suppose, heart-rending tale. And their hearts went out to her.
Yes.
And that's where it all began.
In fact, publisher Jane Daniel was one of those who heard her speaking or heard about that speech at any rate on that Holocaust Memorial Day and really thought, very small publisher, she thought, this book needs to be read, this story needs to be told. And it was she that persuaded Misha to go ahead and write the memoir, and it was she that initially published it. But the cozy relationship didn't last too long.
It didn't. I mean, Jane fascinates me because I suppose documentary makers, journalists, publishers, we're all doing the same thing to some extent. We have our eyes out for a fascinating story, fascinating true story maybe. And I guess Jane's story fascinates me because I sort of feel there, but for the grace of God go I, in the sense that she was taken in. And then as things went along, Misha became less communicative with her. You know, there was a Disney deal on the table. Oprah came knocking. This thing was going to be massive. And then Misha became uncommunicative and the relationship between Jane and Misha broke down.
And not only that, but there was a court case where Misha got a lot of money.
She did. She stood up in front of the court and you can see how sympathies are swayed. And this is one of the things that fascinates me in telling the story, is how emotion can load a story and it can load the belief of a story. You know, here was what looked on the face of it like a greedy publisher exploiting an innocent Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, and that's an important story to be told in there, because first of all, that exploitation would be despicable if it were happening. And not only that, what we're dealing with here is if you give something that's a hoax, it gives Holocaust deniers material to say, look, you see, there's an example of just another hoax.
It does. I mean, obviously, this is a slightly other subject, really. Mm. But I mean, for us making the film, it was in the forefront of our minds all the way along. What I didn't want to create was catnip for Holocaust deniers. And I hope we haven't. I know some funders were initially nervous about being involved in the film because they absolutely didn't want to sign themselves up for that. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, you shouldn't shy away from the difficult subjects and stories. And to some extent, I wanted to wrestle the subject or the story back from the Holocaust deniers by, you know, looking at it from 360 degrees.
So things have gone awry between Jane Daniel, who had published the memoir initially, and then it had gone on to big international deals subsequent to that. There was a French film version made, which kind of told the story, I presume, in a kind of fictionalized style. There were loads of interviews.
Yeah, based on a true story, yeah.
There were loads of interviews in and around that with Misha and the young actress playing the part of the little child Misha that she was. And you know, it's all watching this and saying, God, a very moving story, all of the rest of it. Then Jane is doing a little bit of digging around because she's kind of a little bit suspicious about all of this somehow. And she looks at a document, but Misha supposedly doesn't know what happened to her parents, doesn't know anything about her parents, doesn't know her own identity. And this is what Jane discovers.
After the trial, this was the lowest point in my life. I ended up going into therapy and being diagnosed with PTSD. I had horrible insomnia. I was hanging on by my fingernails. My publishing company was gone. The copyright was taken away from me. I mean, I was destroyed at that point. I ended up doing a postmortem on what had happened, looking at it piece by piece by piece. I was in my lawyer's office going through old records and documents. I had no idea what I was going to find. I open a file, and it's Misha's bank account, and it's in Misha's writing, and it's her signature card. And on there, it says, date and place of birth, filled in Misha's hand, and mother's maiden name. All of a sudden, I suddenly get flash. She knows who she is. She knows where she was born. She knows who her mother was. This was stuff she supposedly didn't know. She lost her identity in the war. This doesn't add up.
Publisher Jane Daniels beginning to discover that things aren't quite what they seemed to be in the case of Misha De Fonseca and the story that she told in her memoir, Misha, A Memoir of the Holocaust Years. Sam Hobbinson is director of the documentary telling about that, the unravelling of that hoax. The documentary is called Misha and the Wolves. It is an extraordinary moment when Jane discovers those documents, and it just totally unravels from that point onwards. It's safe to say, Sam, in terms of how it all falls apart. But you do something very interesting, and I have to be careful what I say here, but you really get us as viewers to buy into certain aspects of the way you tell the story, and perhaps to test out our own critical faculties and see how much we will believe before it's put in front of our eyes what we're actually seeing.
I do. I was really interested to make this film because I wanted to make a film about how and why we believe the stories we are told to be true. I wanted the film to unfold like a thriller. I wanted the audience to know no more than the characters in the film. And I wanted them to experience the twists and turns of the story as the characters did, as much as you would in a thriller movie. So on top of that structure, we've also knitted some, we've used some filmmaking devices, should we say, to knit the audience into the web of secrets and lies that the characters are trapped in.
Yeah, and you do it very effectively, I must say. Certainly, I bought into it. But let us leave that for other viewers to find out for themselves. The woman that I do want to mention before we finish up is an amazing woman called Evelyn Handel. She, for me, is in some ways the hero of the movie.
Yes, she is, absolutely. And it, I mean, it's interesting you say that. You know, we have two main characters in Misha and Jane, the publisher, who are both deeply flawed in their motivations. I wasn't interested in painting heroes and villains, but they are both, and I wanted them to, at different times, to seem either one or the other. And in the course of making the film, another character came to the fore, and it wasn't necessarily the plan early on, but Evelyn Handel is a Holocaust survivor herself who experienced much the same thing as Misha was claiming to have experienced. She was a hidden child in Brussels during the war, but she also was one of the genealogists who helped find out what exactly was going on.
And let's listen to her explaining to us some of the techniques she used, including these amazing notebooks where the identities of children were written down, but written down in about four different places so that you had to have all of them. You'd have all of the pieces of the jigsaw to find out. Let's listen to Evelyn Handel.
There were four different booklets. You needed all four to find the child. But all four of them were in different places. If any Nazi found a single booklet, they would not be able to trace the child. But at the end of the war, With the four different booklets, there would have been a way to find whose child it was. And so I searched for Misha's parents. No names of the parents. So I knew there that there was something wrong. And in the lists of hidden children, they didn't have Misha and they didn't have the wall. That is for sure. She was not mentioned at all.
Evelyn Handel there in a scene from Sam Hopkinson's documentary Misha and the Wolves, and nothing untrue in anything that she is saying to us. But I suppose, Sam, basically what you're telling us in this documentary, or what you're saying to us, it's the old caveat emptor phrase, isn't it? In this case, it's let the viewer, let the reader, let the listener beware.
Exactly. I was fascinated in why, you know, how, why we believe what people tell us is true. And I think what I learned through making the documentary is that, in a way, the truth is, it's all about context. So, you know, Misha was telling a story from the position of being a Holocaust survivor. Her story was out there. It was very, you know, on the face of it, it's difficult to believe. But if it's being told in the context of somebody's Holocaust survival story, it's very difficult for us to disbelieve it.
Yeah.
Because of the context from which it's being told. And I think a lot of the people got so angry with Misha for what she'd done for various, you know, from various perspectives, had done so because she'd played with their emotions.
And we find out things about Misha that perhaps play with our own emotions later on as well. Sam, it's a fascinating documentary. Thanks so much for speaking to us about it this evening.
Thank you very much.
Sam Hopkinson there, director of Misha and the Wolves. A fascinating tale of deception for sure. It comes to cinemas this Friday, September the 3rd. Recorded in lockdown, Camino is the new album from Scottish classical guitarist Sean Sheba. He takes a fresh approach to the Spanish guitar, offering spare, reflective interpretations of an art form that sometimes suffers from overfamiliarity. Central to the album are the works of the Catalan composer Federico Mompou, an artist more usually associated with piano. Suites by Mompou are flanked by the music of other Spanish artists or composers, including Manuel de Falla, and French composers, including Maurice Ravel and Eric Satie. We'll be talking to Sean Sheba shortly. He'll be joining us from Berlin. But first of all, let's have a listen to some of the music of Federico Mompou. Section of the Preludio from the suite Compostelena of Federico Mompou, and that is from the CD, new album Camino, from Sean Sheba, who joins me now on the line. That piece, first of all, and Mompou himself, maybe tell us a little bit about him as a composer, because he's much better known, Sean, I think it's safe to say, as a composer for piano than for guitar.
Yeah, and I think one of the really interesting things he does when he comes to the guitar is that he sort of compresses his language and creates something pretty new. When he's writing for the piano, it's music that is harmonically quite expansive. It's really something that you would not be able to arrange for the guitar. But when he's coming to the guitar as an instrument, he's actually thinning out something and creating something much more modal, something much more linked to the guitar's origins as a four-string instrument, something that texturally is much weaker than the six-string instrument we know now.
Yeah. And in doing so, is he leapfrogging backwards, if you like? Is he leapfrogging the flamenco tradition, or is he trying to get past that or go through that in some way?
Oh, good question. Okay, so this is great because it leads straight to a talking point, which is that I don't think Mompo is really leaning into the Andalusian tradition. This isn't like the fiery, piquant, heart-on-the-sleeve Spanish guitar music that we're used to listening to. This is something much more European. It's much more northern Spanish and indeed links us to the Celtic diaspora of Galicia. In the final movement, there is a reference to the bagpipes of northern Spain. And I think that's something that altogether shines through in this music. It's something a little bit more subtle, a bit more reserved.
And I'm presuming that was the aspect of guitar music, classical or Spanish guitar music, whatever way we want to label it, that interested you in the making of this album, Camino. And Camino suggests, you know, some kind of pilgrimage, some kind of journey. That must have been in your mind. Are you bringing us as listeners on a journey maybe to places that we haven't been, that are not as familiar as that Andalusian tradition?
So the movement that you just heard, which is the preludio from the suite Compostelana, is from a suite that is sort of inspired by the pilgrimage of the Santiago de Compostela. So there's a very explicit reference there that I'm trying to sort of riff on in the album concept as a whole. But aside that very specific reference to something spiritual, admittedly, you know, a very ecclesiastical pilgrimage now has this huge humanist relevance in contemporary life. It's also something quite personal to me because I have avoided the typically Spanish repertoire for a long time. And I think it took a long time for me to come round to this repertoire and sort of feel like I really had something to say. And even when I did realize that I had something to say and it was something that I wanted to say on record, it took me, it was not the sort of typical statement of like, you know, as we were talking about at the beginning, the flamenco vibe. It's something much more reserved.
Yeah, and I suppose something more European in the sense that we do get a Franco-Spanish aspect to what you're doing here in terms of Maurice Ravel is in there. Yes, a composer who is associated with French music, but also very much with Spanish music or a Spanish style of music, if you like. And I suppose the same could be said, not so much of Eric Satie, but, you know, that Franco-Spanish link is important to you in what you've chosen for the repertoire for the album.
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, Mompo's mother was, I think, French, actually. So he's got a sort of very European heritage. And that link there is such a, in a way, it's quite an obvious one. But I think it's one that's been underexploited in Spanish guitar music programming on record so far. I think it's also important to highlight the extent to which Spanish dance forms have been ubiquitous in French music from a pretty early period. So it's kind of a fun little programmatic game to play to be using 20th century examples of that and not Baroque or Renaissance ones present in the Pavan, the Ravel Pavan that you referenced, and the Poulenc Sarabande as well.
Yeah, and also there, I suppose, in some ways, in the guitar sonata that I want to finish up by listening to. This is a guitar sonata from Antonio José, I'm presuming I would say, a Pavan, a triste, a sad Pavan, if you like, from this sonata. What attracted you? Tell me a little bit about the composer, first of all, and what attracted you to his music?
Well, he was he wrote one substantial work that we really find commonly played, which is the 23-minute guitar sonata from which this Pavana Triste, the third movement, comes. He died tragically at the age of 33 or 34, which was the result of nothing less than a village conspiracy in the middle of the Spanish Civil War. It's an incredible story, but basically he was executed by a phalangist firing squad. All the more tragic in the context of what Ravel said of him. He will be the Spanish composer of our generation.
I suppose echoes of Lorca's story, really, in some ways there.
Even he was executed not far from where Lorca was executed.
Very interesting that connection should be there. So the Pavana Triste then, maybe just set us off into that music, that movement from the José Sonata, if you would, Sean.
Absolutely. So I think that the José Sonata as a whole, it's not the most perfectly formed work. I think there are many sort of structural issues with it that one as an interpreter has to deal with, grapple with, contort the piece to make it work. I think there are isolated moments of perfection, and I think the Pavana Triste is definitely one of those. It's the reason I did not include the sonata as a whole. It's tragic, it's understated, and it's incredibly beautiful.
And this is that Pavana Triste from the Antonio José Guitar Sonata, third movement, Sean Sheba performing from his album, Camino. Thank you. Havana Triste, a section there from that third movement of the Guitar Sonata of Antonio José, that from Camino, released on the Pentatone label, and it is performed by Sean Sheeby. It's not often that a book not only offers its readers a shot of adrenaline in the form of a madcap crime caper, but also gives us a complex cast of characters. And, if that's not enough, the future promise of a cabaret show. That is the case with Luke Cassidy's debut novel, Iron Annie. Set in Dundalk, among the criminal underworld, it spills off into a road trip through Britain with a host of characters from our narrator, Aoife, and her enigmatic sidekick, Iron Annie, to the ever-obliging Garda Kelleher and the fierce King Rat. The book will transform into a stage show this coming autumn, with songs and monologues based on episodes from the book, doing a Thelma and Louise-style tour of Ireland. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by the author of Iron Annie, Luke Cassidy. How would you describe this world of the narrator of your novel, Luke, Aoife, and her friend and sidekick, Annie?
Thanks for having me, Sean. How would I describe that world? It's a kind of a larger-than-life version of the sort of borderlands world of Dundalk and the surrounding regions. I guess over the years, augmented by my own imagination, having been away from the place and then coming back and rediscovering it.
Tell us a little bit about your own relationship with the town, as they would call it in Dundalk itself.
Yeah, well, I'm from Dundalk. Spent a lot of time abroad after graduating from college. I suppose, like a lot of people who grew up in not only Dundalk but places like it, you sort of have this perception that it's a place to grow up and go away from, and that certainly would have been my experience. But it was only much later in life, after having spent time, as I say, abroad elsewhere, that I kind of came back and rediscovered, you know, a whole new vibrant world there, and sort of especially in the arts. And I think this was kind of as a consequence of lots of different factors, including just Dublin getting too expensive for people, and people returning to smaller towns around the country.
So is it safe to say then you're not looking at a gritty realism here, a gritty realistic representation of the criminal underworld in Dundalk? You're looking at a much more of a surrealist expression of that. Would that be a way of putting it?
I would say neither a sort of a journalistic style. You know, it's not The Wire, which was written by a sort of former journalist. It's not that. It's not either. Surreal in a genre sense, but it is this kind of like larger than life comic in the proper sense of that word, view on this world. As I say, it kind of, through the writing process, which was a spontaneous one, I didn't sort of plan how this was going to go. It was as much of a roller coaster ride for me as it will be for anybody reading the book.
Well, listen, we'll come back to your own process and how that happened, but it strikes me that there's a touch of Lisa McInerney's Cork here, if you could transpose it to Dundalk, into Luke Clancy's Dundalk, or Luke Cassidy's Dundalk, I beg your pardon. That's what you would get. You're going to read a section from us called The Chicken and the Moth. It's in the vernacular, and there's lots of the vernacular within the book as well, as in broad Fs and lots of other language within it too. There'll be a little bit of that in this section that you're going to read to us. It's quite early on. This kind of tells us about Annie and Aoife, the narrator. It tells us about them.
Yeah, it's all about, and I suppose that's what I would say about the kind of the gritty aspect, the crime aspect. This is really a kind of a vector into Aoife's obsessive relationship with Annie, who is this character who is very much at the heart of the book, but never shows herself entirely, not completely, to Aoife. Well, always escapes her.
Let's hear a little bit of that section.
I'll be glad to, The Chicken and the Moth. Getting to know Annie was like, well, you know young Buck, the poor fiend who pushes the big rock up the hill again and again, not getting nowhere every time he got somewhere, spilling over the edge into nothing. Like a chicken scratching at the same patch of dirt, all bewildered by the mere fact of being a chicken, just scratch, scratch, scratch until the urge comes over you to lay a fucking egg, and even that, you don't know a fuck why you're doing it. Like the moth going round the lamp that's left on, just smashing into it and brushing and burning all night until it dies. For a full year, my mind was just a stupid scratchy chicken, a kamikaze moth, scratching and bumping and burning round Annie. And I still think her every day. several times a day. Used to consume me, used to be all I thought about, sitting there scratching me hands far past blood and feeling sorry for myself. Pure waste of time, though. Annie, she wasted everyone's time, but in a way where you were mostly happy to have it wasted. Mostly.
And that's a section there from Iron Annie, debut novel from Luke Cassidy, section called The Chicken and the Moth. And very interesting. Look, I was wondering what would happen in terms of how you would read this. It kind of, your accent is very quite neutral when you're speaking to me as Luke. But when you're reading from the book, obviously as Aoife in that particular case, it does shift very subtly into a Dundalk accent. Not an easy accent to pin down, it has to be said.
Mine.
No, the Dundalk accent is not an easy accent to do. Is it a much maligned, much underrepresented and much hated accent for loads of wrong reasons, do you think?
The accent itself, yeah, well, it was funny, kind of like very, this sounds like a canned statement that I prepared, but it really happened. I was out today with Cormac, the publicist, and we bumped into Conor O'Callaghan, another author from Dundalk, outside the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar, and we just, oh, two Dundalk authors, here we are, and we had this kind of brief exchange about the Dundalk accent. I sort of, yeah, it has that aspect too. I think it is hard to pin it down. It is hard to kind of get that. I remember hearing it was a comedian, a woman, I can't remember her name actually, just offhand, but she had a great description of the Dundalk accent as the kind of like low, almost nasally tone that you might adopt if you were trying to lie to the guards as they were asking you what was in your boot and why did you have it. That sort of says a lot about it, I think.
Well, it probably is something that Aoife, your narrator, might find herself doing on more than one occasion, lying to the guards about what's in her boot,
She has quite a cosy relationship with the guards, actually.
Yeah, with Garda Kelleher. She has a close, two women, and they have a close relationship, for sure. Although we're never, again, a bit like the Annie relationship, it's not quite pinned down. But talk to me a little bit about that criminal underworld, then, that you put Aoife and Annie into, because they find themselves having to kind of, you know, do this big drug deal that they get themselves involved in. But it puts all sorts of pressure on their relationship, first of all. But also, it's a very dangerous world that they're in.
It's a very dangerous world. I think this is sort of a kind of an extrapolation of the border wheeler dealer identity, which is an identity which I was talking to somebody about that recently. I kind of explain it as something that kind of was born of the necessities of the border region and partition, the hardships that was thrust upon them. I think that's kind of key to understanding Aoife's character. She sort of sees herself as this sort of wheeler dealer character, but you know, there's no knowing where that will kind of lead her. In a sense, she's quite freewheeling as a wheeler dealer.
Yeah, And there's also this aspect, she finds herself travelling through Britain, as I said, as part of this drug deal that she's involved in. Yeah. She's trying to make some money for herself in the process of doing so. And Brexit inevitably comes up in some of her conversation. But would you consider yourself in any way a political writer in that respect? You know, the fact that you're talking about this border wheeler dealer, you know, the border is very much in our minds at the moment in terms of Brexit. Do you think that aspect is in the book in any way?
You know, I think that it's very difficult to write about anything without being political. I think that you can choose to extract yourself from that. I'm not trying to make any kind of political manifesto in Iron Annie. It wouldn't be for me to do that. But I think there is a reasonably honest kind of expression of how frustrating it has been for people in that region, broadly speaking, to have again the imposition of a lot of insecurity and a lot of worry, and you know, not knowing, are the bad days going to come back, or how will that, you know, again, this was written a couple of years ago when Brexit was still, nobody knew how that was actually going to unfold.
Still, not sure still don't, much further down the road. Anyway. Annie is a bisexual woman. Had you any qualms about taking on that voice? You're not a woman. You're not a bisexual woman.
I'm not, indeed. Do you know, this, I suppose, comes down to the question of process, which for me was very much at the beginning of writing Iron Annie. I sort of started this as a spontaneous writing experiment.
So really. Just explain what you mean then by a spontaneous writing experiment.
So I sat down with a very simple prompt. It was an idea that was given to me in a workshop that I attended in Scotland with Welsh writer Niall Griffiths. And so it was an idea to start off with a couple of words and kind of do a sort of a mind map from that and then launch into a piece of spontaneous writing without really planning it out what you wanted to do. And that was when everything in the book kind of started coming up, including the vernacular writing, but also the identity of the protagonist. In the beginning, I assumed the protagonist, because it was a first-person protagonist, I assumed that this is a man. And then I slowly discovered, as she was telling me things, that this is not a man. And
so you are a writer then, that the characters speak directly to, or was that just the case in this writing prompt that you were following, or this writing exercise that you follow?
Yeah, no, very much from that moment on. Previously, I'd written a lot, and I'd even tried planning out what a novel should be like and how it should work and all that kind of thing. But in this case, I just sort of sat back and tried to abstract myself as much as possible from the process.
But having written about a bisexual woman and putting a bisexual woman as the narrative voice in your novel, I mean, you'll have heard of recent novelists who have landed themselves in dodgy places and difficult times because of taking on... writing books about other identities. What did you do then to check yourself on what you were doing, if you like?
Yeah, I suppose I'm lucky to have a lot of very literary, very clever and well-read and well-educated and very critically minded women in my life who kind of kept me right on that. That's one thing. And then the other thing was sort of, as we proceeded in the editorial process and the book was acquired in Ireland, the UK by Bloomsbury, and then across in North America by Vintage. Actually, they were very, very attentive to that. And they commissioned a sensitivity read by an editor who is a bisexual woman, particularly to watch out for that, you know, and, you know, also, I should say that, you know, my editors were also women. So this is kind of obviously something one should be very attentive to. And I was in the process of writing. And then again, there was the added layer of Vintage having a sensitivity read, which I think was very important.
Finally, a stage show.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me how we are going to see Annie, Iron Annie, and Aoife, and the Rat King, the big drug dealer in the town, and Garda Kelleher indeed, and the various characters. Will we see them all on stage, or what are the plans at the moment?
Yeah, no, it's not a traditional theatre show in that sense. How it's being presented is as sort of theatric monologues, again from the perspective of Aoife. So she'll be telling a lot of the stories that you read in the book. And that combined with music, which has been has been composed from the chosen sections of the book by two bands, the Dandelion Few and the Pickled Onions, who are both Dundalk groups.
Have you found the Dundalk woman to play Aoife yet, or what are you going there?
I have an actor, Eleanor McLaughlin. She's not from Dundalk, but not too far, somewhere in between Dundalk and Dublin. So, that's all right. She's a professional. She's already done the audiobook.
Right. So you've heard the voice and you liked the voice.
Yeah, we had a lot of back and forth about that.
All right.
That's all good.
Well, thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Luke Cassidy and Luke's book, Iron Annie, out now in hardback, published by Bloomsbury. Information on the Iron Annie Cabaret can be got from junctureArts.ie/Iron-Annie-Cabaret. A new solo dance performance called Minshock, yes, that's the word, is a love letter to the Irish language, a navigation through past and present and future of Irish culture and dance, and in fact how all of that might play into our identity and the expression of that identity. The performer and maker of Minshock, Sibéil Davitt, is with me in studio right now. But before we talk to Sibéil, let's have a listen to Cormac Begley and the music, one of the pieces that he composed specially for this performance. Thank you. music of Cormac Begley there, and that from the show Minshuk, and the show's creator and the performer in that solo dance piece, Minshuk, Shabeel Davitt, is with me in studio this evening. Let's get this bit out of the way first of all, because I had my Muintir Scoile pen, my red pen in my hand earlier today, saying, that's Mishnok, surely. They misspelled that, the misprint. No, Minshuk. Explain. Mishnuk means courage, of course. Mishnuk is a different word.
Exactly, exactly. And you wouldn't be the first to say that. And it's almost like that little speck of dirt on the screen you want to rub out. But yeah, Mishnuk is the Irish word for female goat, a nanny goat. So there's the Irish song, you probably did not a great job of that. But yeah, I was looking for a title for the show, and I don't know how it even came. I even came across it, but I was like, "Wow, that's so perfect!"
And Minshuk, a kind of she goat is what we're talking about here.
And the images I kind of see is just this kind of wild goat or this wild animal, and obviously female as well. So, and I like how it's a play on courage as well, and kind of a bit of a head scratcher and a bit of a conversation point. But I feel like she's grown and involved since then, and is her own thing. So, yeah.
She's her own woman, as it
she
were.
She is, yeah.
Give me a little bit of your own background in dance, because obviously you listen to that Cormac Begley piece. I mean, the entire production area was jigging up and down. I was jigging up and down in the seat here, and I don't think you could sit still as you were listening to it either. So dance is very much at the heart of this. But what's your own background in dance, Shabeel?
Yeah, so I am a contemporary and traditional dance artist, and I have been practicing both Shannos dancing and contemporary dance for a long while now. I learned Shannos dancing from my mom, who's from the Gaeltacht area of Tuairimeacadie in Mayo. And then I also have been doing classical dance and contemporary dance for all my life, and have an MA in contemporary dance as well. So I've been kind of on this endeavour to find a dance practice that's both traditional and contemporary, and kind of not to fuse both, but have them both integrated in the practice.
Agus, you know, tá Gaeilge agus tá Ghuachas, you were brought up as Gaeilge. So tá Gaeilge sa seo freisin.
Tá cínsa agus tá dá hanga cinál fita fuita agus ar bhealach ní mórán tanga ann ach tá sé dán le chéile.
You have both English and Irish there. And I guess in some ways the two languages, is that similar to the two styles of dance in terms of you for your own identity? I guess you can't have one without the other.
100%, you've got it there. So, you know, kind of after a while I was thinking, how important really is it to show language in the show, because the language is the dance, and I suppose if it's not shown through the dance, I'm not really doing my job properly. So yeah, there is some text and some interesting parts like that, but the main language there is the dance, and it's mixed in with the Gaeilge and Béarlachuma.
Yeah, and I suppose we could argue that it's trilingual in some ways.
Exactly.
Dance, Irish and English.
And then music as well, if you consider that. Yeah.
It's a polyglot. Okay,
exactly.
For that. The piece that we just heard, Cormac Begley playing for you there, how important is Cormac's music to what you're actually doing on stage, and the way, you know, to dance to that must be an extraordinary feeling. 3 minutes and 6 seconds, I'd say. You know you've danced to it when you get to the end.
It's when this actual track comes on the show, I'm already very, I've already danced a lot. So it's really amazing to really find the impetus. Like, the music gives me so much when I need it in the show. And what that's doing really is bringing me into place of memory, a memory of actually dancing this track with Cormac. And
dancing to that live, is it?
Yeah, and also preparing to do a performance with him with a recording of it. So a lot of the show are kind of dropped into past memories of dance, and this is kind of an exploration combination of that and kind of being in there in just the euphoria and freedom of it as well.
And that piece is an original piece composed by Cormac.
It's Master Crowley's. It's a traditional tune, but he's obviously
done his thing to it.
Yeah. So that's it comes at a really interesting time in the show and offers something.
And how did that collaboration with Cormac come about, and how does it fit into, if you like, the other music that's within the show?
Yeah, so the sound designer of the show is Sinead Diskin, who has done an amazing job of the whole thing. And we were, you know, looking at lots of different found music. There's music, there are memories of other pieces that come before that. But I was trying to think of something that would, as I said, bring me into memory in a very particular state. So I chose that one in particular because it's a very recent memory. So I asked Cormac, would he do that for me? And he did, of course. So he's fantastic.
And
yeah,
you got that. Now, memories, there must be one memory, I presume, this makes its way into the show somewhere or other, 2009.
Oh.
Winning the TG Cahir, Buihor, Las Vegas, of course.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that experience and how does it feature in the show?
Las Vegas, yeah. So 2009. So that was the thing back in the noughties, was the game show and the talent show, Britain's Got Talent and all that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I wanted and went to Vegas and it was all a really fantastic experience. But I suppose I've only really been, looking back at it now with like very fresh eyes and kind of looking at game shows in general and how you know what that does and where it sits, I suppose, with dance and entertainment and art and where do they all kind of, what place do they all have together? So I suppose I'm looking at it now as with the older eye and reliving it and putting myself in a situation where I have to compete against myself. So that's the hardest competition, that one, isn't it? It is, of course. Yeah.
You also, I think it was around the time of Las Vegas that you started to collaborate with the actor and writer Katrina Ní Wuadhachu. Has Katrina been involved with you on this show?
So yeah, so I actually started working with Katrina in 2019. So for this particular show, and it's been amazing. Katrina has been really integral in making this, and really that dramaturgical eye, and helping me a lot with the text, and really looking. I suppose I think she looked at the footage and she was like, "There's no way this isn't going in it. I mean, this is gold." Yeah. You know,
it's too good. Yeah, because there is a. I mean, I saw a version. I think an in process or still in progress version of the show online, a video version of it. And yes, there are quite definitely, there's, you know, up at the back there are projections onto the back of the stage, which gives, certainly Las Vegas is in there.
Absolutely, yeah. And I suppose you're able to see the old version of me and the present version, and you can compare and contrast which was better, I suppose. But
I hope I'm not giving the ending away.
Okay, no worries.
But
no worries.
You start in bare feet, and it's very interesting to watch you dance in bare feet, and how the hard shoe technique is, obviously it's in the feet, it's not just in the shoes.
Yeah,
the shoes
yeah.
only do what the feet are doing inside. But you progress your way through to hard shoes, certainly later on in the show. How important is the footwear simply in an expression or in an exploration of Irish dance?
That is a great question, and it's so funny. There's so much taking on of shoes, taking them off, and but yeah, I suppose I wanted that to be a part of it, and to really show the act of putting them on and how long it takes, and the in-betweeny bits as well of that, and there's the waiting to go on and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's really important, and I really wanted to show the full range of what can be possible with percussive dance, so bare feet, and the different sounds and how they're mixed in. And Sinead live mixes all the sounds.
It's Sinead
live.
Diskin, the sound designer.
And especially in the first section, you can kind of see this first section continue to grow. Yeah,
as it gets chewed along the way.
That's it.
Well, listen, Gurmila Mahagat, that's well, I'm an oct.
Shabail,
David on Shin. The show is called Minshach, and it's not a misprint, M-I-N-S-E-A-C-H. Previews from September the 14th at Dreacht in Blanchardstown as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. And you can find out full details on fringefest.com. That's our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme, produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow, September the 1st, believe it or not. 7 o'clock, as usual, here on RTÉ Radio 1.